every other year, I teach this course called World of the Old Testament. And the way that I've done it before is the usual, well, boring way. I'm just trying to hit as many things about life in the ancient Near East as you can. This year, somehow I got the idea, someone suggested case studies along the way, and I'd been thinking about Ruth, and so we took the book of Ruth and spent the entire semester just talking about how understanding different aspects of the world of the Old Testament helps us to understand the book of Ruth. So what I've done here today, or what we're going to try to do in 45 minutes, is summarize what for me would be the whole semester. but more like a few of the highlights and what for me were some of the takeaways, some of the things that I learned that I didn't realize before, or maybe that I kind of knew, but I got to learn much more about this year. So let me just give you a few examples, and then what we're going to be focusing on is what we used to, well, I don't like this word, the plight of widows. Okay, whatever a plight is, you know. A plight, it's a word that rhymes with flight, so that, you know, poets can use it in some way. I don't know. But we'll talk about widows. But notice here, just a few things. I put several aspects of the context of ancient Israel, the ancient Near East, that we talked about, and actually there are more than these. But let me just give you a couple of examples, like the first one up here. The literary context. The literary context. Now, I'm assuming that you all know the story of Ruth. I would encourage you to do what we did in the class, which was to have a dramatic reading of the book of Ruth. We did it in less than 20 minutes. So you can do it and then still have time for conversation, for discussion afterwards. But just assign female voices to Ruth and Naomi, male voices to Boaz, to the elders, from whoever is talking. And it's really amazing then, we did that and then just generated all sorts of questions. And that's how we kicked things off, and we only answered about half the questions that were raised. It's just amazing. But anyway, literary context, okay? Just a little bit. The literary context of Ruth. What is the literary context of Ruth? Where it falls in the Bible. Guess what? That depends on which Bible you're reading. If you're reading our English Bibles, which are based on the Greek Septuagint, then you read Ruth in the light, in the dark background of the book of Judges. And there's some great commentaries that take this approach to say, notice the message that you have in Ruth in contrast to the awfulness that is going on at the end of the book of Judges. All right? And, you know, Ruth is this point of light in a very, very dark time. But guess where the book of Ruth falls in the Hebrew Bibles? At least the one I have, the what we call the Masoretic text. Guess where it falls? Right after the book of Proverbs. It's one of the five scrolls, one of the five megaloths, they're called. Ruth, Esther, and some others. Well, it's very interesting, because what's the last chapter of the book of Proverbs?
First
was woman. That's right, a noble woman. The very same phrase is used by Boaz to say, this is the way they're talking about you, Ruth. They're talking about you as a noble woman. The very same words. So how interesting that the end of Proverbs uses this word to describe this, you know, kind of woman that a good woman wants to be, and then it's immediately followed by a story about Ruth, who is described as just that kind of woman. So if you want a living illustration of a noble woman, read the book of Ruth. See, so we talk about literary context, one of 15 different aspects of context that we talked about this year. Another one, just for information's sake, religion. Religion, what are you talking about? Do you know how the Jewish faith incorporates the book of Ruth into the rhythms of their year? every year. It is read during the Feast of Weeks, what we call Pentecost. All right? Now, it's interesting, because then you think, oh, the whole story must take place then, right? No. Chapter 1 actually falls about the time of Passover, when harvest begins. Chapter 2 says at the end, now we're at the end of the time of harvest, Pentecost. All right. So reading Ruth in the context of a time of the end of harvest, you know, really gives it a cultural context there. It's read as a part of the other things that they do at the time of Pentecost. Guess what else they do at Pentecost? They focus on the law. The law. I find it rather interesting to think about Ruth as a dramatization of the living out of law. Because there's nothing in Ruth about sacrifices. There's nothing about priests. All the things that we tend to associate with law are not there. Instead, you've got Ruth. And so you're hearing law and Ruth juxtaposed. So there's all sorts of things like that are going on. And you can see this list just goes on and on and on. That's just a couple of teasers. Maybe sometime we can come. You can take the class. We'll do it again. But let's focus in on widows and some of the stuff that we learned about widows. Now, for this, you've really got to get into their context. This has helped me. This has opened my eyes up so much this year to understand, to think about the situation of widows in that culture versus our own. All right? I mean, we know that widows face uncertainty in our culture, but the uncertainty of it in their culture, to me, seems much, much more serious. All right? Much, much more serious. So, notice here, just a few things that kind of encroach and hinge upon this. Limited resources. That should be obvious. I mean, what are we talking about? We're talking about a dry climate, kind of like California without irrigation. All right? So think about how you might have to grow your own food. And we spent some time talking about how did they harvest it, where did they store it, what critters might come and get it, what other way. Anyway, won't go into all of that. But limited resources, okay? Now, one of the main ways that in this culture that they came up with or that they had, that they used to deal with this is all these patry things. It was patriarchal, patrilineal, patrimonial. What does that mean? Oh, yeah, the guys are in charge. They're telling the girls what to do. Well, that's part of it. Not real. We see it as power trips going on. But it's more about how do we achieve and maintain financial stability? Where does that come from? And the institution, the structures that they set up to deal with that was patriarchy, patrilineality, those things. Which meant if there was going to be an inheritance, it was going to go from father to son, from male to male. Why? Because in their minds, that was a way of creating stability. Now, we'd really like to be able to get back there even before Bible times to find out why they saw this as a way of creating stability. What factors were involved? We can speculate, but that's all it would be, is speculation. But notice this. Family, we talk a lot about family values, biblical family values. Family was primarily, or almost indistinguishable from business. Okay? Everyone was involved in maintaining and contributing to the financial well-being of the family. You were either contributing or you were pushed aside. At least that was the attitude. Now, there's no lazy people around here. There's no freeloaders. You are contributing in some way. At least that was the idea. Now, they also recognized that some people had a harder time than others. Old people are not as strong as young people. Young kids are not as big as adults. They can't all do everything. And so there's what sociologists call a division of labor, and different ones would do different things. The most common speculation is that the reason why it's a patrimonial that the guys get the loot, if you will, is because they could do the most work. And you couldn't make a go of it with the family farm business if you didn't have strong, able-bodied men. Okay, and so just that's speculation. We're not exactly sure. One other factor in this: have you heard about honor and shame societies? You do things out of honor. You do things because that's what's expected of you. If you don't do that, you're considered shame. You're being selfish. If you do something selfish for yourself rather than for your family group, then that's something that is shameful. If you do something that is shameful, why is it shameful? A big reason is because it's damaging, it's counterproductive to the family. Okay, there's a lot of these things. We spent 4 hours on each one of these ideas, and I'm doing them in less than 4 minutes. So, I put up here then the word accommodation. See, when it comes to widows, the strongest parallel I see to this in our society, when it comes to widows, as they get older, as they become less physically able to contribute to farm work, you have to make accommodations for them. Right? In other words, somebody else has to pick up the slack, or you have to make allowances for them. But guess what? You only do that to a certain extent. There can always be a breaking point. Is it economically wise, worthwhile to make these accommodations? We wrestle with that, right? In a different way in our own society. We'll come back around to that. But this is what makes life uncertain for widows, is that it's easy for the society to say, oh, they're not contributing physically in the business the way others are, so they are pushed down the totem pole. Right? That can happen. The same thing, we're talking about widows. Same thing happens with others. Who else comes to mind?
Orphans.
Children. Yeah, same sort of thing. So, in your handout now that some of you got, about three-fourths of you got, I've given you just some examples to show you that the common refrain that we know of from the Bible, of taking care of widows and orphans in their distress, James chapter 1, I think you're familiar with the fact that that goes back into some Old Testament passages as well. The reason for the handouts is to show you, first of all, that Israel was not alone in that. That was a part of their culture. All right? Look at the first two examples. There's a Canaanite city-state called Ugarit. Maybe some of you have heard of it. Back about the time that the Israelites were in Egyptian slavery, we have writings from that group. One of their legendary kings was this guy named Daniel, probably mentioned in Ezekiel 14. go and look it up. It's written out as Daniel, but probably not the Daniel, a contemporary of Ezekiel, but instead this guy. But notice what it says about him. Here's the king, Daniel. He got up. He sat at the entrance to the gate of the city of the guard. He sat next to the granary on the threshing floor. The threshing floor. And what did he do? He judged the cases of widows. He presided over orphans' hearings. See, that was sort of a quintessential, a typical sort of thing for a good king to do. Right? And you see the similar sort of thing with this guy. How do you say that? It's Egyptian. I don't know. Amen, M-O-P. Is that O-P from... Amen, M-O-P. Anyway, he too talks about how people should take care of, the wise person should take care of widows, orphans, the poor. Look at Hammurabi. We're more familiar with Hammurabi. Look in the latter part of his laws here. He says, I am Hammurabi, noble king. And then he goes on and on and on and on and on and on about why he's so noble. And then at the end, what does he say? In order that the mighty not wrong the weak, to provide just ways for the orphan and the widow, I have inscribed my precious pronouncements on my stela and set it up before the statue of me here in this glorious city. See, that's sort of fundamental to what he does, is to take care of widows and orphans. Now, the laws then, I give you three laws here, and there are more, but these are laws that go into why or how widows need to be taken care of. In other words, the challenges that they might face. And it's rather interesting to see these. The first one, notice, 170. What it's basically saying is, if a man has, let's say he's playing Father Abraham, and he has a wife named Sarah, and she has a servant named Hagar, and he fathers children by both of them. The question is, will they each get an inheritance? Well, it depends on whether the father has said, you are my children. See, it's kind of automatic with his wife's children, but the maidservant's children, he has to declare somewhere along the way, and probably has to seal it and all, you are my children. But if he doesn't say that, if he doesn't officially, legally acknowledge them as his children, well, then they got to be dealt with differently. When he dies, you know, things have to kick in. All right, so you have examples of that. Now, here's my question. Why or when would widows turn to a king for help? You read about it in the Bible, and my impression used to be, oh, well, you know, that's just who they turn to. You turn to the government when you need help, right? Mm. No. Your first line of defense against poverty, if you're a widow or an orphan, is your extended family. You turn to the Boazes of the world. And only if they cannot or will not help you do you then appeal to the king. Let me give you two quick examples from the Old Testament. Maybe you're familiar with these. The first one, 2 Samuel chapter 14. Remember the woman of Tekoa who comes to David? Now, it's a made-up story, but it's very, very true to life. Basically, the story is the widow comes and says, help me, King David. I had two sons. They got into an argument. They started playing Cain and Abel, and one of them killed the other. And now, my family wants to arrest the killer and execute him. And what will that do?
You've heard that in your
house. Yeah, but what does she say? She said, my husband's name will not be continued. Now, what she means by that is exactly what you said. She will lose her means of support. She will not be able to maintain the inheritance in the name of her dead husband. Because they're taking away her sons, who are supposed to be inheriting that. She is losing the right to property, which is the basis of their financial stability. They're taking away her bank account. See?
All right.
Similar sort of thing happened. two parts of the story. Are you familiar with the story of the woman of Shunem who helps out the prophet Elisha in 2 Kings chapter 4? Now, how does Elisha respond to her benevolence to him? You know the story? That's the other one. That's Elijah.
Okay.
This is Elisha. In the case of Elisha, yeah, Elisha says to his servant Gehazi, what can we do for this woman? She's been helping me. And he says, oh, it's a rich man and woman. They're fine. But you know what? She doesn't have any kids. So, when her husband dies, she'll live on retirement, right? No. She'll lose her financial basis. So, if she has a son, so he gives him a son. I'll skip some stuff. It says then, a couple of chapters later, chapter 8, that there came a time of drought. The woman and her family left their home for a while. They have come back now. Now they go to the king. Why? Somebody else squatted on their property while they were gone. And the king gives them their land back. See, but they didn't have the extended family in place to speak up for them. So the kings are the fallback, the final recourse, not the first recourse, the final recourse for widows and orphans. If the kings don't step in, oh my. Who knows what could happen? Now, got to move on here. On the other side of your handout, we don't have time to read this, but I really encourage you to do so. This year, during the semester, I was so happy to find this, because here's a modern-day example of the very thing I'm trying to explain to you. Rwanda. Nation of Rwanda. Here's a group of law students from Yale who went and studied what's going on there, and one of the big things they found was, guess what? That inheritance in Rwanda traditionally is patrilineal. It's patrimonial society. And if you want to inherit something, it's got to be from father to son. All right? And widows are in trouble. And a lot of them were, because there's all of these women who have been left as widows following the deaths of their husbands in this genocide. Well, guess what? The other extended family needs the land. They have scarce resources, and they need the land. And the widows are saying, well, it's my land. And the uncles and cousins are saying, your husband, our brother, our cousin, he's gone now. We don't recognize you as his wife anymore. You don't have any share in this inheritance. So read the description there. It sounds exactly like the sort of thing that Hammurabi tries to deal with in his laws. It's amazing. And these are the sort of things that Ruth and Naomi are facing in Bethlehem. This is the possibility that they face in Bethlehem. Now, if you think, well, that just sounds totally unbiblical, think about this story. This one didn't dawn on me until this semester. You know the story of Hosea, the prophet Hosea. He talks about how he marries this woman, Gomer, and there's the question of whether she starts off as a prostitute or becomes one, but whatever. They have three children. The first one, don't worry about. The next two have these horrible names. Okay? One of them is named Na'la. Oh, Hosea, you and Gomer just had a child. What are you going to name her? We don't like her. No, what are you going to name her? That's what we're naming her. We don't like her. She's unloved. And then he has a son. Gomer has a son later on. What are you going to name this one, Hosea? I hate to ask. Oh, that one's not mine. Well, what's his name? Not mine. not my people. See, it's exactly the opposite to what Hammurabi was talking about. Say, if they're going to have an inheritance, then the father must say, you are my son. You are my people. And Hosea says, my child is named not my people. In other words, I am disinheriting these children. The father has the power to do that. Okay? Shows you the kind of power that these folks have. So, with that in mind, just think about this. I need to do this. It just sounds so cold. But this is what Ruth and Naomi are facing in Bethlehem, is that here they are. They have been away for 10 years. While they've been away, you know, that they left. Remember, Naomi left during a time of drought. Now they're coming back. Can you imagine what has happened in the years that they've been away? What's been going on with the property? When the famine has broken, somebody else has come in, and they started working the land. They have started getting dependent on that. They have gotten where they expect to have that. And now, Naomi shows up, ready to take her land back. Only people wonder, can she? Apparently she does. We don't know if there was any negotiating that had to go on. There is this interesting note, though, in chapter 4. When Boaz starts negotiating with the elders, what does he say? But what has Naomi done? She has sold her husband's property. And he's there. He's saying someone needs to redeem it, to keep it in the immediate family. You know, Elimelech, the dead husband, keep it in that family. Right? Okay. So that suggests that she had some rights. Now, if her situation is the same as these women in Rwanda, basically what she has is the right to work the land and make whatever she can from that. Now, think about when Ruth and Naomi came home. What time of year is it?
Harvest.
Oh, all right. So they're able to gather food at the harvest. What are they going to live on between now and the next time of planting and another harvest? So they got to think about that, number one. Number two, if they're going to have this land, somebody has got to work it. Somebody has got to plant the seeds. Somebody has got to get out the weeds. Somebody has got to bring water to it in some way, if that's possible. They have to work the land. Naomi is never described as gleaning or doing these other things that Ruth does. My guess is she's too old for that kind of work. So she's relying entirely on Ruth. There's no way that one person can do that. So Naomi's going to have to start hiring people to do this. My guess is something like leasing the land, where they work the land that's hers, and she gets a portion, they get a portion, something like that. But these other folks around her, the cousins, uncles, nephews, they're thinking it would be much easier if we could just take over this land and use it, expand our own financial base. So they are at the mercy of the other guys around them. See, to make a go of it here. So they're looking at this, Boaz, the other kinsmen, the other people in the town, they're looking at this and they're saying, wow, you know what we're seeing? We're seeing one old widow who's no longer able to work the land, and she's getting older every year. So whatever benefit she might be to the group right now, that is going to be, in business terms, cold calculating business terms, her input is going to be declining over the years. And guess what? She doesn't have any sons or grandsons who down the road we might count on to contribute to this business. Wow. Tough times. Tough times. So, see, the children can grow up and become productive business, you know, contributors to the business. But at the same time, they are encroaching on the hope for the expected financial base of the other people around.
I feel bad in saying this. It just sounds so unloving.
And Ruth is such a loving story.
But that's the cold, hard fact.
Okay. So, before we get to Ruth and Boaz, let's look for a minute at the kinsman. The guy that Boaz turns to first, says, Naomi has sold property. You have first right, first dibs as the closest relatives to buy that back. To show that you are a team player, to maintain the property of our fallen kinsman, Elimelech. You see? So show that you're an honorable person. Don't shame us. Step up and do your part. And this guy says, yeah, I'll do that. I will take over responsibility for Elimelech's property. And then Boaz says, now, of course, when you do that, not only are you taking on Naomi, but you're also taking on Ruth, who is still able to bear children, and any children she has would be considered Elimelech's, carrying on his inheritance. Wait a minute, so what are you saying there, Boaz? Are you saying that I'm supposed to give my time, my labor, maybe some of my laborers, to building up somebody else's wealth? So, he says, no, if you're going to throw Ruth into the mix, that might damage my inheritance. Right? So, for economic reasons. Now, look, he's been allowed to save face. It's been allowed to save face. So it's like, yeah. Okay, he's willing to make some sacrifice, but not that big. But there's something else here. A lot of people wonder if the ethnicity of Ruth also contributed to his unwillingness to step up here. Okay. And you see here, humans tend to be suspicious of. We have this bad inclination to feel like we can dehumanize humans who we feel are sufficiently different from us. Right? That's, for some reason, that's the way we are. And you know, so yeah, they talk different, they look different. They play football. They don't even play football. They call it football, but it's not football. They do things different. Now, I put up here Ruth 2, verse 9. Some of you might want to look that one up. Something that we just kind of, well, maybe you don't, but in the past, I just kind of read over. Just zipped on by. First conversation between Boaz and Ruth. Boaz is telling Ruth, you can glean here, you know. You can stick around and glean. And guess what? I have told the guys not to touch you. What do you mean? Told the guys not to harm you. I've told the young men not to bother you. Harass you. Attack you. Now, sure, these good, righteous Israelites would never think of such a thing. But after all, she's just a Moabite.
Who's going to stop us? She's not one of us. Well, who is going to stop her? Boaz.
And we need to be aware of that. Now, I've got a whole long thing we're going to have to skip because I want to give a little time for reflections. But let me just point out to you something that I think is important for us. We did a whole section in the class on law, and a part of that was looking at biblical laws. And then we went into attitudes in the biblical laws toward foreigners. Guess what? It's kind of complex. Because you have some laws, like Deuteronomy 7. Deuteronomy 7 says, don't marry non-Israelites. Because what will happen if you do?
They'll lead you astray.
They'll lead you astray because they'll corrupt you. Right? And in fact, you go a little bit further. Chapter 23, they pick on Moabites and Ammonites in particular. Don't worship with them for 10 generations. Moabites. Right? But then, skip down to Deuteronomy 24. There it says, be sure to take care of widows, orphans, and aliens. Why? Because you were aliens. You were foreigners in Egypt, and God took care of you. All right, so don't marry them, but take care of them. You know, they're going to corrupt you, but welcome them with open arms. Feed them. Provide. All right. So, especially do not marry a Moabite or an Ammonite. Okay. So we wonder if some of that is going on here. Okay? I'm leaving out so much stuff. Led into a very interesting discussion, prompted especially by an article on immigration and the absorption of immigrants into society. And what this one particular article, sociological article, was looking at was when do immigrants become fully accepted in their new host society? So we asked the question, when does Ruth come to be regarded as Israelite? And I imagine many of you had the same reaction that 3/4 of my class did, which was, oh, that happens in chapter 1. We all know the confession. You know, Naomi tells her to go home, and she says, no, I want to give you something that women can say when they get married. Where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your God will be my God. Your people. So surely, if she's adopted Yahweh as her God, now she's an Israelite, right? Well, several times throughout the rest of the book, they refer to Ruth as Ruth the Moabite. She's the foreigner. She even refers to herself as a foreigner. Why are you helping me, Boaz? I'm a foreigner. All right. In chapter 2, in responding to Boaz at one point, she says, why are you helping me? I am not one of your servants. I'm not even one of your servants. Now, the next chapter, she turns around and says, at the threshing floor, here I am, your servant. So did something happen there? Some people say, oh, she becomes an Israelite when she gets married. No, now she's got a green card. And other people say, no, it's the next paragraph, when she bears an Israelite son to Boaz. And then other people say, Ruth is never an Israelite. She's always a Moabite. Now, the next generation, not sure, so sure. So there's some uncertainty about that. But it plays into how is she treated and why is she treated the way that she is. Okay, so boy, there's so much here. The relevance of Ruth. I see so many parallels, so many analogies that we might pull from Ruth that I didn't, I mean, some I recognized before, many, many more that I recognize now. But let me just pull up a few of them here. First of all, I think in the case of Ruth and other widows like her and Naomi, that we are faced with the practicality of counting the cost. You know, is it worth it? You guys ever heard about discussions in families when grandmother or grandfather or great-grandmother or great-father, they get sold? Who's going to take care of them? Are they going to move in with one of their kids, or are they going to? Well, who's willing? They all should feel the same obligation, but who's willing to step up and actually do that? You know, you got to weigh the pluses and minuses, the costs versus the income. Very, very practical thing to be doing. Cultural integrity. When we think about immigrants, okay? We're having a huge discussion about this in our country right now. And one of the things that this brought up is always mentioned is, what are they going to do to our culture? With some arguing this is going to enrich our culture, and other ones saying it's going to destroy our culture. So it's interesting, you know, to consider. Just, I'm not saying, you know, which one is right or wrong. We just noticed that that was something that they probably were struggling with at the time. What will be the effect of having this Moabite woman come into our community? Now, it's interesting, when Boaz talks about Ruth, all he talks about is how people are praising Ruth. You ever notice that? Because I've heard about, they're talking about what a great worker you are, how much you love your mother-in-law, on and on. Okay? But I wonder about the other kinsman. Was he worried of how it would look for him to be married to a foreigner? And if Boaz is being portrayed as having greater righteousness by being willing to accept that because of character rather than her nation of birth. And then what about religious devotion? Can we accept these people, or are they going to undermine not just our cultural values, but our religious values? Can we accept, here's some people, you know, they moved here from Texas to California. Don't know if we can trust those people. You laugh, I've heard it the other way around. I used to live in Texas. My wife came from California. People wanted to see her passport. All in jest. All in jest. You know, and yet we are suspicious of those who are people. And you see that, I think, as an undercurrent in the story of Ruth. What else do I have here? A little bit more. Oh, yeah. So, what I would then hold up, a takeaway, and I think, you know, all this stuff we've really been talking about is background. But notice how Ruth and then Boaz are held up, I think, for their righteousness. I don't know that that word is ever actually used, but I think that's what's going on. You see their righteousness. These are just some things I noticed. I wish we had more time. I think you guys have, you've looked at this and you can see other things, but notice how Ruth is honoring of Naomi, of her family of marriage. She honors that more than her family of birth. Wow, you know, what do we do with that? I think they're holding that up as a noble thing because of for other reasons. She's wanting to sustain her husband's family. Notice how she makes herself vulnerable. She puts herself out there. She takes risks for the sake of the family. See that? I think that's a part of righteousness. And then she's relying, she has to rely on the goodness of God, which she acknowledges, and the goodness of the Naomis and Boazes and other people in the community. And then Boaz, you see his righteousness. He's honoring God. From the moment you see him, you know, he is greeting his workers with a blessing from God. And they are responding in kind. And I think that that then sets us up for the way that he treats Ruth, the way that he honors Ruth for her actions. He recognizes her righteousness. He ignores her foreignness and notices her righteousness and honors her for that. And so he advocates for her. Do we do that? Do we advocate for the immigrant? Protects her? And he himself makes himself vulnerable for the sake of Ruth. So I think that I think that's the main takeaway we're supposed to take from.
I am out of time.
One quick question.
Yes, sir.
I've always wondered if why does Mahon, why does his name not appear in the lore?
Yeah, I wondered that too. We did a whole thing on genealogies and levirate marriage and how you're supposed to be carrying on the name.
The name's gone.
But the name is gone. You get Boaz instead of Mahlon.
I don't.
Maybe they're just talking about property and inheritance and not really talking about who's left in the genealogy. That's my guess. But I just find this whole thing fascinating. This whole thing fascinating. If you want to gather around and talk about that, we'd love to do so. Thank you for coming.